you. Can you hear me?
Oh, very well.
Good.
I have my headphones on and everything. Hi. Well, did we ever met? I don't think we have in person.
I don't think we've ever had the pleasure of meeting you, sadly. Maybe one day.
Yes, and I want to thank you so much because even I remember clearly from my earliest show with Tara von Lintel, former Thomas, I remember you purchased one of my small drawings even before I started doing the large ones. And then with Jeannie Freilich, you did again, and with both of them. And I'm so grateful. Thank you.
Well, I'm grateful to have the work. And I continue to watch you with great interest. Where are you from today?
I'm actually in my studio, and I love to have this conversation at the studio while I was working. I'm in my studio in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, where I've been for a lifetime. Yeah.
I see. And how has it been for you the last few months? Has much changed?
That's the perfectly worded, as you say, has much changed, because not really, since I'm always here working, so my life is already kind of isolated during the day, and solitude is a big part of it. And what's changed, of course, is not being able to go out at night, which I like to do often, to go to listen to live jazz and see a few friends. But I have been used to in my life through some periods of, it's funny you ask that question because, well, it's a question everybody asks these days anyway, right? My parents, as they were growing older, they both passed away already. I had to spend long chunks of time with them, in hospitals or when they were sick, or just keeping them company when they were even in their 90s. And I remember just feeling that it's easy for me just to hang on my own with my artwork or with a book and not have a lot of interaction. So not a lot has changed, to be honest with you. And I can still go out and run in the park. I have a park across the street. So if as long as I can exercise and have my artwork and reading, I am pretty okay. Yes, I miss people, of course, and hugging my friends, but my life didn't change as much as most people. Yeah.
Have you had to resort to digital devices more than usual, or have you managed to just stay more independent and enjoy the solitude?
I think it's kind of being the same. Maybe the conversations have been longer, and I love that people are more available to have a long conversation on the phone instead of a short text, mm-hmm. because people don't write letters anymore. And I like to converse. I actually, as much, maybe because I spend so much time alone, when I am with company, I love to have a conversation.
You have a lot saved up to say, huh?
I'm afraid so, and I'm a bit of a talker too, so.
I can relate to that, absolutely.
Right, you can, I hope so. I'm always a little wary about my use of screen time, and the only social media I have ever had was it's Instagram, and I'm mm-hmm. still a little concerned of the time I spend there and how much I might rely on being visible or not. So maybe this time of more profound solitude makes one more aware of relying too much on that. And I have gone through periods of being even more careful as before, as how much time I spent on the phone and on the computer. So ultimately, it always boils down to being more careful about the real time you spend with people, like what we're doing now, or working on the artwork, or doing whatever you're doing with focus. Because I think the screen time can make us very distracted and diluted, right?
Absolutely.
So I'm always struggling a little bit with that, but I have my ways that I escape that, mm-hmm. which is through I mean, when I don't feel well, I know generally, or always the solution is breaking the resistance and going into the work or going out to exercise. Mm-hmm. That's usually like my medicine.
It's good to know how to manage.
Yeah.
It's good that you have recognized the tools that you need to manage to stay balanced.
Very much.
Certainly during this time, we're far more self-aware.
Yeah. Have you felt like it's like, at least in my life, my goodness, I've been trained for this. Because also psychologically, like the whole idea, we can spend hours talking about resistance and what resistance is, that even when you are an artist and you love doing your work, and I know, you know, I speak with writers and even with athletes, how is that place where you wake up or you're not doing what you should be doing and the resistance that there is to make that step to go do it? And how is it once you make that step, you're in heaven?
Mm-hmm.
But the resistance, yeah. That wall, the mind, right, that keeps you going,
yeah.
Like, oh, no, today's raining. Oh, no, today I feel tired. And this time, I think, for the worst or the best, depending who you are, this time really brings that into the surface.
For certain.
Yeah.
You have no distractions.
Exactly. And
so...
whatever distractions you come up with, you can clearly see that you're that they're like crutches that you are
right avoidance or
exactly.
Reluctance or yeah
exactly.
I'd like to have you travel back to your younger years and tell me when and how art began to enter your life.
Okay, are you ready for a? I'm thinking.
I am ready. I'm ready.
I'm kidding you because it's like the long answer or the short answer, and I would say
you
always get the long answer. Thank you, Joanne. I always drew, and since kindergarten, I remember, and I have very little memory when I was little, but I do remember. Like the first time I dealt with color and like with gluing things, and I think, and I remember I was very shy and very fearful of other kids, but I always felt safe making art. And I always felt, even since I was very little, that I had a very unique, unusual approach. And that became very relevant when I was like in my probably 11 or 12, 10 in, I was a horrible student. I was very unhappy in school, but art class was it. And it was where I put 100%. But the funny thing is that I was always abstract. Since I was a kid, I didn't want to draw flowers or bears or stars or unicorns, nothing like that. I remember, and the teachers were always like, whoa, when there was art class and we were asked to draw flowers, and I would do like a synthesis of that, very much what I do now, like a line in a circle. But it was done to like perfection.
So let me interrupt a second.
Yes, please.
Was anyone else in your family an artist?
Well, no one was, but everybody was. And here is why. My mother was originally a hat maker, and my grandmother too, and I think the great-grandmother too. And my mother was making hats with her mother since she was a child. And my mother's hat, she had a store, and she had a shop, a studio, and she made hats that were really so bizarre that I was even embarrassed sometimes. Because it was, and she sold them really well, and she really made a name for that. And then my father worked as a manager of sales for like Caterpillar, but he sang opera, and he studied opera, and nobody was wealthy, but my mother had a store since she was, I believe, like 19 years old, and my father had to go to work so early too. They married when they were like 20 or something, and my father had to stop his opera studies and singing opera, and then he did a lot of radio announcement and like soaps on the radio, very creative. But my brothers were extraordinary draft men, But there were like no art books in my house or art in the walls, or no one spoke really about art. But indeed,
and you
is something
didn't go
that,
to museums.
Oh no, that yes, that's you're asking the perfect questions, so you can put me on. I don't go forever on one question. I grew up in the business district of Bogota. Imagine Midtown here. Imagine two blocks from MoMA. That's where I grew up in Bogota. So, and I was an alone child. My brothers were 15 years older than myself, so I never lived with them. And I was able, since I was like 11, 12 years old, to go alone from, my mother had a store in a hotel, and we lived, say, four blocks from it. Within those, let's say around 10 blocks from that area, there was every single museum that existed in Bogota in the 70s, and the only gallery, and the only large bookstore. They were basically across the street from my mother's store and three blocks from our apartment. So alone, my playground was this business district in this hotel. And I was always alone going into everybody's stores and going into where? The National Museum. I started going, first my parents took me some time, and then it was next door, after a while it was next door to where we live, in the Museum of Modern Art. And there was one gallery that it was called Buchholz, and I think it's the same Buchholz family that has other galleries around the world. But anyway, this was a German man who had, there was a big bookstore, and the gallery, it was a tiny gallery, and they always show European, like Miro, and European masters, little works. And I used to go there and be completely fascinated, like blown away. And I remember in the museum of, in the National Museum, the paintings of a landscape painter. His name was Arisa. There were these landscapes full of, how do you call it, landscapes, very mysterious landscapes that look very Chinese almost. And I have these memories as a young girl and as a child being blown away by it. And so I was very, very in touch with art, not being aware of that I was, or my parents making any effort. It just happened naturally.
Did your mother do a lot of drawing in preparation for making her hats?
No. All she did was, she would do the drawing to cut the pieces on the...
I see.
No, because
the
not
pattern.
True even. Yes, sometimes the fabric, because the felt came in one piece.
I see.
So she did a lot of sewing and a lot of... More, it was more like the work of a sculptor.
Mm-hmm.
But she was very creative. Then she made a house on her own, and she made the lamps, and she made the mirrors. And my whole family was very creative, but no one... It's like I never thought art, or they thought art. Actually, I always thought more like music. And when I was in the middle of high school, I decided that I was going to be a choir director. And I joined a choir because somebody in school came and did a testing for all of us and said, oh, you have a great voice, you should sing. And I ended up in this choir, and I was like, wow, this is my life. And I was doing horribly in school, as usual, and being very bored. And then I won a prize with a little drawing, citywide prize with all the schools, like a painting prize. I was skipping math class and went and did this little drawing. And my drawings were usually pretty good. And but they were so easy for me to do that I never saw, like, this is like art, and I'm the artist. But I knew I was different. And I went to the choir. I was at the choir for a year. And I have to tell you the story quickly. And there was somebody's boyfriend who used to come and pick up this girl that was at night before my father picked me up. And he had a little notebook under his arm. And I asked him what that was. And he said, well, this is my drawing. So I look and I said, where did you go for drawing? He said, I go to this painter in Colombia. It was a very famous guy who had an art school in Bogota. And I said, anyone can go there? And he said, yeah, anyone can go. So that year... I did very badly in school, and I won that prize, which that gave me the only art magazine that Colombia had at the time as a prize. And I was thrilled. I was 16, and I was receiving with my name this art magazine, and I convinced my parents to let me quit high school to go to art school, to this one school where this kid was going. And they agreed. So I quit school at 17 and started art school, and my mother demanded that I work in her store and that I go study English in the morning, and I would go finish high school at night, which was kind of a joke. And for the first time ever, I stopped fighting with my mother. They saw that I was a dedicated person. I didn't need to be, it's like life completely changed at home for them and for me. I became completely focused and happy, and I grew up. And I went to this school the first day and never looked back. I sat there, I started drawing, and it's like I found home. And I thought, oh my God, this is me. I realized every day going there that I was an artist. And when I came here to the U.S. to go to school, I never considered school as a school. It was, I was very arrogant in the sense that it was like, I am going to learn techniques, but no one is going to teach me what to do. And the teachers that supported me through art school were the ones that left me alone and said to me, you need to be left alone. In a nutshell.
Were you focused solely on drawing the whole time?
At that first school, because the education there was the old academy. This was an artist who came, who was really like hyper realistic and very much almost like out of the old fashioned schools, the old academies in Europe.
Right.
So it was mostly focused on drawing. We did a little bit of color, and then I came here and I joined the Art Students League, and I love drawing. So I did drawing, and I did the figure for, my God, 2 years in Colombia and 6 years in New York. Almost drawing life figure every day, but I make a parenthesis here because I started working as a model for artists and schools as a nude model to support myself after I looked for a bunch of jobs and I didn't like anything, and finally I found that job that taught me so much. That job got me, I think, to be even a better draftsman and being a model. And like if I were to teach now life figure, I have a lot to say, and I think people should go and stand in that platform and hold a pose and go back to draw. Anyway, and I learned about meditation, yoga, doing that too. But then at the Art Students League, I started doing printmaking. I did it for a couple years, and all the technicalities bored me. And curiously now, I'm doing printmaking here at home. I have a press now. But I'm not much into technical stuff. And painting, I always wanted to paint. But every time I went into a painting class, I couldn't stand all the people around. And I couldn't stand drawing the figure, painting the figure. Like, drawing the figure was a thing, but painting didn't really appeal to me because I was never really interested in realism or narrative art or doing... I was always really interested in abstract. And then finally after... I always felt that I wanted to sculpt, and I had a teacher who used to scream every time he saw my drawings. He used to say, oh my God, you're a goddamn sculptor. You got a goddamn sculptor. So, and I used to look at the stone carvers, and I was really, really enamored by it. So I went into stone carving, and I did it 4 years. I did 3 years at the Art Students League, and then I went to Europe. I got a grant they gave to students every year to go to Europe. I got that, and I was so lucky. I went to Pietrasanta and did 6 months of stone carving. And then when I came back to New York, I realized that as much as I loved that passionately, it was keeping me, I didn't feel like I was flying, just the whole idea of the pedestal, and I needed so much help, and the studio and everything, and the noise was such a big deal that I thought, okay, it's time for me to paint. And I started painting on my own, and since then, I really haven't stopped. I miss sculpture. I think all of my work is very informed by sculpting. I have some pieces growing slowly in my studio, but so I feel that yes, I am a sculptor, I am a painter, and I am also a, what do you call, a draftsman? You know, it's like I love to draw, so I do all of those things, and I think my volumes and all that are totally sculptor-based forms, right? They're, in all of my work, there's a lot of volume.
Well, do you keep a journal as well as draw?
Yeah, I do. It's very disorganized. I'm very organized.
Is it a steady part of your practice, though, to journal?
I would say it's steady, but not in the everyday. I'm a very disorganized, organized person.
I understand that.
Right? Good. Yeah, because it's like I have a lot of journals, but sometimes I open them and they're not dated, so I sort of put a date. My writing, I can say it's pretty, but it's ugly, and it's big, and it's small. It's like, I don't know, there's like a lot of different moods, and I'm not, how can I explain this? To answer your question, yes, I keep a journal, but it's not every day. There are chunks of time where I go there every day. Like on my drawing table, I make a lot of notes, and then I forget to transfer them on my journal. So when I clean the table, say after weeks of working and it's a mess, I cut all the little bits of notes and put them inside of an envelope. And I think someday I'm going to put them in a book, and they never go in the book. But
that's a kind of journaling, too.
Exactly.
Journaling doesn't have to be just writing, and it doesn't have to be the same form. It's a part of a process.
But it is writing. It is writing as far as, and I do a lot of writing, and I have like two or three books going at the same time, and there's one I carry in my bag. And there's another one I have around my, that's why I say I'm organized, disorganized. It's not like I have one book that is sacred and I write and it's very clean and you know, everything has a place.
And do you ever go back and look at some of your earlier work?
Yes, a lot, actually.
And what happens?
I do that a lot because since my work is always flows freely, and it's an intuitive process, right? It's like I work like on a, like automatic writing. And it's, I want to say this also since you ask about writing, I often feel more affinity when I read or talk with writers about their process than with visual artists, because my process is very much like the process of a writer. So, you were asking me, can you please remind me, because I deviated a little bit of your last question.
I'm curious, when you go and revisit some of the work you've done a long time ago, what happens for you?
Yes. For me, it's very healthy to do. It's not like I do it a lot, but I do it often. I open my drawer and I bring down drawers. And I love when people come to look at my work in the studio and they make me pull drawings, and because of my disorganized organization, I don't have my drawings necessarily stored in the files of past, future, and now. I mean, past, how would you say,
in chronological
organized
order.
Dated.
Yeah.
Exactly, thank you. Mm-hmm. They all get sort of mixed up, and people come and see them, and then I don't have time to do all that organization, so everything is sort of pulled together. And what I realize is, I don't feel that time does exist. Like, we are living a linear time here because we need that in order to understand our existence. But I think in reality, I like to look at things more, and especially with this quarantine, but also with what's happened in my life for the last 8 years, I have lost completely a sense, chronological sense of time. It's become very warped in my existence. So when I look at work, I realize that there are things that I'm doing now that I wasn't aware that I was doing 20 years ago. And I go, oh my God. And like with the blue, people ask about the blue and it has to do with this and that. And I go back 30 years and blue was always there. It was indigo blue. And then, and the spheres were there. I remember when the first sphere came up and I remember when I started multiplying them. So going back and forth actually informs my work. It's a gift. It's almost like when I go and look at my work in the past, it informs now. So it would be almost foolish for me not to look back. And when I don't, I realize, you know, okay, sometimes I feel a little like dry. Okay, what am I doing here? What's coming out? And always looking at work in the past brings me into, it's not like I ever go, oh, I did this then, I'm going to do it now because I don't work that way. But subconsciously something gets steered. It's almost like going back in psychoanalysis. It's like it's good to look back because you see the good, the bad, and the ugly in a way, you know, as a matter of speech. And it informs you. It informs who you are. It informs where you come from. But in this, you know, in this abstract universe that I inhabit. But yeah. So, yeah, I love looking back.
Have you thought more about this blue? And this strong attraction you have to that particular color?
Yeah, and I have lots of different answers that come at lots of different times. In one hand, as I told you, it started with indigo, and I think the indigo has something that has to do with unity. It has to do with, like, why is blue like the uniform, you know, on almost everywhere for organizations, because it's easy, it's not black, it's blue has a, I'm trying to find, like in Japan, how blue and indigo, and most people don't know that the blue jean came to be popular before it was popular here. It was really popular in Japan for in the beginning of the 20th century for farmers. They would dye it and they will use it for a lifetime. So blue for me always had this kind of modesty. The indigo, it's almost like I chose blue to be my black. We're talking about indigo. It has something that had to do with like when you write with a ballpoint pen, it was often blue also. So it came from that as something that was always like a constant that everybody uses, that unifies. I don't know if that makes any sense. And then when the ultramarine blue came up, At that time I was very aware that I loved, remember architectural blueprints?
Oh, yeah.
When they were done by hand?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I love those. And I have asked, you have no idea of all my close friends, I think they're all, as most architects are, they're very proud of their work and very proud of themselves. So I have begged them to give me their blueprints so I could draw over them.
Uh-huh.
To this day, no one did. Everybody said uh-huh. they would, and they didn't. Uh-huh. So, and I love also architectural drawings. I love geometry. So I started using this ultramarine blue, sort of thinking of that powdery electrical, which is a little bit more purple, but it's not like, oh, I'm going to make drawings based on architectural blueprints. So, but that was kind of there in the back of my mind, and that's when I started also working the larger drawings. And there was I almost never make a conscious decision before doing the work because I have no control on what comes out. But there was a conscious decision that I wanted to go monochromatic in order to make easier this move from small watercolors to large ones. I wanted to facilitate my move to that. So I thought, if I don't have to think color, I'm going to work with this blue. And then the intensity of that blue happened through the process of working with it, that I go over and over and over the lines, and I wet them, and then I go over again. It's almost like making a tattoo on the skin. That came up just out of the process. It was not planned. It just, like with all of my work, it just sort of happens. And boom, there it was. And it's so powerful that it's like, what now, 8 years at least, since 2012, that I have been working a lot. I wouldn't say exclusively, but probably 80% with that blue. I'm trying to do other things now, but that's still going, yeah.
I mean, I identify that blue with you in your artistry. And I actually had a profound moment. I hadn't been attracted to blue typically. Just my eye went to green and reds and not so much to blue. But I had a breakthrough with one of the bigger pieces of yours that I purchased, which was all blue. And I don't know, I saw it and I had to have it. I felt it so deeply and strongly, and it was a profound moment. I later recalled that I had just visited the new Middle Eastern galleries at the Met,
mm-hmm.
where there was a preponderance of artifacts that were blue, and that rich, deep blue.
Yeah.
And I think I ingested that as part of that culture, and came out of the museum with this strong feeling for that blue. And then the minute I saw your work, I was so comfortable in it because I'd had that experience at the museum. And of course,
that's
now
wonderful.
I absolutely love it. But
it's
an extraordinary piece. It's a really beautiful piece.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. I love that piece and all the pieces that come up because it's the blue, I think, something we haven't spoken about, and I don't generally speak about this unless I'm asked about, but like for me, art, the journey of art is not a career, it's a vocation. And I had that very clear from the beginning that it's a spiritual path to me. And that's one of the reasons I didn't go to college.
It's certainly how it flows for you, isn't it?
Yeah, and I've been like, when I have consultations like with shamans and all that, it's always, I like astrology, so in the astrological chart I've been told, like, look, your work, what you do in your life and your spirituality, one doesn't work without the other. So coming back to the blue, now that you reminded me, I also had an affinity. As I started working with blue, I have a lot of blue china and things in my house, but in regards to what you just told me, it's so beautiful and important for me because I have heard it from other people. And that's what I think art is supposed to do. That it affects me while I'm working on it, and when I decide that a piece is done, I always feel that there's this, that I am organizing energies, and that this blue came into my life. It's like, as I'm telling you, it's like it came into my life. It's a choice I made, but it was kind of there. And the vibrancy of this happened. It's not something I planned on going there. And then the end result, like the byproduct of this, is something that I think belongs to the spirit. How does a piece of artwork communicate to another person? Why it does communicate to some people and not to others? Some people don't see it at all, don't feel it at all. And ultimately, it's a matter, like you said, of feeling, like you, there is a transformation. And there's a vibrancy in this, and that's what I hope to, I mean, I don't hope, I don't really work, think like, oh my God, I need to make art that's spiritual or anything like that. I always realize after the fact that these works are about energy and that I'm working with something that I don't even quite understand, but that is kind of it is kind of a mission in the sense that it's unavoidable, that it has to come out, and that there's a reason why it comes out. And when the work is alive, I usually say, well, it does. It has a beating heart. Does it have a soul? And that's how I read art. Very much just said that. How do you perceive it? What do you feel? And I'm incredibly, you make me so happy by saying that you felt so strongly and that this opened to you that door to not understand, but to be one with blue, right?
To really connect with it and feel with it. I have these experiences often throughout my collecting history.
That's
I have
beautiful.
These breakthroughs, and it. My theory is that I carry my life history in my body and in my mind, in my senses, through my senses. And when I'm profoundly drawn to a work, I have to trust that.
Yeah.
That there's something in that that's connecting to something in my history. If I have that strong intrinsic response, I have to trust it. I've learned that I need to trust it.
Yeah.
I don't need to know what it is or why.
Exactly.
I will discover that over time. But I believe I really believe my subconscious drives my aesthetic. And the integrity of my collection is based on my intrinsic response to all of the work I own. And,
beautiful.
And consequently, I can track the history of my life through the collection by these moments. So when I look at your work, that particular piece, I remember exactly when I saw it, how I felt, and then I remember seeing those objects at the Met and that blue and how struck I was, and they go together. And I think much of what you're describing to me is you have to have a real sense of trust in yourself, yourself go and just as your process is one of just letting it evolve and trusting it. And that means somewhat freeing yourself of a tight rein on the intellect, which a lot of artists fall, get trapped in that.
Absolutely.
So it's interesting. I want to know what you do. I mean, it's intense. I know it's intense for me as the observer when I'm looking at art and I'm so drawn to something. I don't want to be disrupted. I don't want anybody telling me what I'm seeing or talking to me. I just want to be with it and feel it. And so I imagine it's like that for you when you're in the making mode. But you also need to break that. And so what in your practice allows you to just relax and play? Just, some artists doodle, some artists do something that's not in their, play with clay or just something that isn't in their regular mode of making outside of that.
Yeah.
Is there such a thing for you?
I want to answer that, but before I answer that, I wanted to go back a little bit to what you just said before about having trust.
Mm-hmm.
I think... having trust in the idea of not being afraid, not having fear, it goes together because basically I was telling a friend a few days ago that every day I start from zero because every time you go to the studio and I grab a brush, it's a beginning of zero because I never have cut out what am I supposed to do with a piece? Never. It's like I never know where it's going, so I have to have trust in that it's going to go somewhere, and I have this phrase that I write on my wall sometimes and keep in mind that if nothing is finished until it's finished, because a piece might not look done until the day is done, and that could take months. So I can never go into the studio with a goal, like I am supposed to finish an art piece today or this piece is supposed to satisfy me today. I just wanted to say that it's about that, like throwing yourself into the abysm, jumping into the emptiness all the time. It's an amazing training. It's like almost like the training of a samurai. When people start making art or young people, they say, oh, I'm an artist or I want to be an artist. I always tremble almost because it's like, are you sure you're ready to? What you're signing up for? Because this is really what it is. It's like a life of you being trained to completely lose fear and trust yourself completely.
It's about the unknown.
The unknown.
It's about allowing yourself to come something in the unknown. And it is only in the state of unknown that you can experience true wonder or awe.
Exactly.
Because once the mind knows it, once the mind has experienced it or the body, it can never be the same. Because then there's that anticipation.
Yeah, and connecting that with this quarantine, that's another thing that I've been trained really well. It's about the unknown. It's like, this is my expertise. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to freak out.
Yeah, exactly.
So, right? So that's one thing. And to answer your question about how do I play, as I explained to you before, like I always have like this resistance, but to break the resistance, I mean, as far as doing the work, there's nothing I can do to loosen up except that getting into the work because, let me see, I have dozens of pieces of artwork around me that are on different stages of development, right? So I guess when I need to break through and start, how do I start? I often pick up a piece but it varies all the time because I might have a piece from the day before that I know I want to continue just going into something that is a little more mechanical with going over some blue lines, but other times, I'm not answering your question. Let me rethink it a little bit because it's a very expansive. I can answer that very expansively, so I'm trying to focus. What things I do that get me in the mood, so to speak, right? Well, music is a big one. Although I do a lot of things in silence, but I love music, and music really opens, brings my energy up and makes me connect to that part of me that needs to be, which is the non-intellect.
And there's a strong connection between music and art as well.
Huge, yes.
I mean,
huge.
even the terminology. I mean, I was a music major in college. So, in fact, oftentimes when I'm speaking to students about drawings and about art, I'm using musical phrases, musical language.
Yeah.
Just because it's what I know.
Yeah, and I think it's the same language, especially with abstract work.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
I listen to a lot of jazz. I'm passionate about all forms of music. I'm very eclectic in my taste, but I'm very into experimental jazz and or jazz in general, that it's more like free form. And I create that very much with the work of all abstract artists and my work because it's about freedom, but it's freedom within a structure. You know the structure, you know the notes, you know your skill. I really believe in working on your skill, but at the same time, you have to completely break loose and float and fly. And I think music, even some classic, you know, like Bach, you hear that kind of configuration, non-configuration. So music is a big, big part of
music is very abstract.
With what I do. Yes,
music is
the same language.
The most abstract art form.
To me, that's what for me, abstract work and music is kind of the same. It's almost like the abstract work is almost like the manifestation in visuals of the music.
Right.
Almost, right?
I understand that, yeah.
Yeah, and that's one thing. I have a friend who brings me Japanese incense from the Temple of the Thousand Buddhas in Japan, so I always have some sticks of that. That I need that. And definitely, well, you asked me maybe for a more direct question, what do I do in the studio? I don't do scribbles and I don't sketch also because my work is actually my scribble and my sketch. It's all in the work. So I don't have pieces that are sort of like sketch pieces. For me, it's very important. Like, I exercise, I go out, and I do yoga, I practice yoga almost every day or every other day.
You know, it's how you break away from the rigors of a studio practice and find moments of ease, and what do you do during those moments? It's different for every artist, and I'm always curious. You know, I visited Jacob El Hanani, whose work is meticulous and small and minute and intense, and he has a drawer next to him full of cartoons. Mm-hmm. So when he takes a break from the rigors of his practice, he pulls out stuff, and he's drawing these figures in cartoons, and they're very good and funny. But for him, it just allows his hand to loosen, it allows his mind to loosen. And, you know, so everyone has some, for you, maybe it's running.
I got your question exactly. No, for me is that I have so many different pieces of work at different stages that I can go to small works, or medium works, or a large work. So I find a work as an entry point that I can start without, that it doesn't have a lot of pressure, you know?
Right.
I always approach each work without expectation, because if I have these expectations, this work is supposed to be a great piece, and where is it going to go? I'm already done, fried for the day. It ruins everything. So I don't go there. So I just grab the work. I have this approach. I answer this question to you. When I was a stone carver, I learned a great lesson, because I did stone carving by hammer and chisel for many years. And it was like, thunk, thunk, thunk. Mm-hmm. And I can say those were some of the happiest moments in my life, because I went to that Zen thing that is like, it is okay if I spend my life just doing this. The end result is not important. It's that I'm doing. So that's what I try to do, or what I do in my studio when I come to my studio. It's not about I'm going to make great art, or wow, I have all these works this is my work. No, I'm just a humble worker. My clothes are full of paint and very humble, and they're my favorite clothes. And this is who I am. This is my most essential me, Yvonne Estrada, with my clothes full of holes that are soft and old, right? And that I sit on a table, and this is my job. I came to this life to do this job. This is, so I like this idea of like joining the whole mode of like the shoemaker and the farmer and all of the people that are waking up to do their job. There's a part of me that feels very much at peace knowing that. And I know that once I go there, then the work kind of happens on its own.
Well,
it sort of happens on its own. I don't have even to think about it.
It circles back to the beginning of our discussion, circles back to your mother, the hat maker, and every day what you witnessed with your mother and the materials she worked with and the forms she worked with and the way that she moved materials around to create the designs for these hats. You witness that. You're comfortable in it. That's your zone. And I would venture to say, if I looked really closely at some of your works on paper, I would see elements that might speak to the veiling or some of the materiality or shapes that you witnessed in your mother's hat shop.
Well, it's possible, although that lasted a short time in a way, because she had to stop in, I was born in 1960 in December, and pretty much within 8 years, I think, in 1960, there was a moment where hats were not fashionable anymore, remember?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
She had to stop, and she just had a store of like souvenirs, and she stopped. But what I would dare say is that while she was doing all of that, I was already in her shop playing with all of those materials.
Right, that's my point.
So
you ingested it at a very young age when you were already drawing, when you were feeling and aware. And so that's
being
part of your
busy.
DNA. And I think it's in your everyday. So
that's although, you know, in school, like I was useless. I couldn't function. I would go to school, and I didn't want to do what everybody was doing.
Well,
it was so dictated,
you know, your day.
It was dictated, and there were a lot of things, I think, but that's a whole other conversation about Yeah, being also because I always been kind of a loner while making the art. Even when I went to art school, I always put myself in a corner and I make rules and regulations that I wouldn't speak to anyone, because speaking to people will waste my energy. Not waste my time, but it will use up my energy. So I learned very quickly not to smoke and not to drink caffeine and not to talk, because I could see how the difference that all that made once I went to the work.
Right.
So there's a whole other thing about the concentration and the focus that the work demands. Right?
Well, I have taken up more than 45 minutes of your time.
Oh my God, you can take five hours.
I think we would have to have part two.
We do, because my answers tend to be very long, and I love your questions, and that you, I love to hear also more of, I love to hear your appreciations and your own experiences and have the conversation going around that. It's beautiful.
Well, it's a magnificent life I live in this art arena, following drawings and meeting artists and looking at their work and living with their work and feeling their work and reviewing my own history in the context of that. It's very rich.
I feel really fortunate.
And, you know, every artist in my collection is important to me, because I've learned something from every drawing that I bring in. I learned something about life. I learned something about another human being, and I connect with another human being through the work. So,
well, it's so beautiful that because true collecting is an art form also. It's so different to, you know, when someone buys a piece because, oh, it looks pretty, they want to decorate, you know, and there's a whole other thing when you have this passion for art and drawing, and then you want to have it and you want to possess it, and your life, it's so intermixed, and it's all part of one thing. I think it's an art form as well. Of course it is. I don't think so. It is. And
well, it's a beautiful thing. And there is no drawing in my collection that's more important than another. I revisit works from 15 years ago, and they have just as much meaning now as they did then. So
there was one more thing that I just wanted to add to that whole experience of growing up with my mother's shop and the museums and the gallery around, is that I think something that had a great influence in me also, because I was a child alone, just or playing in my mother's shop or going around these stores and streets. There was a gigantic, this was the only international big hotel at the moment in Colombia. And there was a gigantic store that had a big section of magazines, and they had magazines from all over the world. And they would lend me these German and French and North American magazines. They would lend them to me so I could take them to my mother's store, and I could spend hours looking at them. And I think that had a big influence in me also, because it was so much visual, you know,
yeah,
and fashion and advertisement and all of this. When as a kid that I went back to drawing, all of that was informing also.
Of course. Of course. And
so
magazines were so magnificent.
Oh, my God, right?
Yeah. And the international magazines especially were magnificent.
They were art. I mean, really, yeah, it was art. And now we're so bombarded by so much visual when you ask about the phone and the computer, it's so overwhelming now. It's so overwhelming that it is absolutely of essence to get away from all of that sometimes and shut the door.
Yeah.
Because it's much too much and not very well, not curated, because who's going to curate that amount of information that comes?
It's
too much, and it's a lot of garbage, I guess.
Yeah. On that note, we will carry on this conversation at another time.
There are so many
more things I'd like to explore with you. But I've restricted these to 45 minutes because I have so many to do. But I'm very happy to meet you.
Me too.
Sorry it's by phone. But I'm it's always, now the work will have even more meaning to me, because now I feel I know a little bit more about you and your personality and your background, and it's always helpful.
Thank you,
Joanne. So I want to thank you so much for contributing to this, and this recording will go into the archives, and we'll make it accessible to graduate students who study the collection, and we'll feature them periodically on our website as well. So.
Thank you. I hope I was not too bubbly and went all over the place.
No, I enjoyed it immensely. You answered all. I didn't have to ask too many questions because you answered them all. Sort of in the course of answering one, you answered many. So it was very easy and fun. So thank you, Joanne.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you. And I love to get more opportunities.
I hope
Thank you so much for everything.
You enjoy your week. Bye-bye.
Okay, you too. Bye.